Spirit Radio Podcasts.
Well, something that's certainly up for discussion a lot is anytime a new school is announced, it's who is going to run the school and who's going to be the patron. And maybe it's happened in your area where there's been kind of competition coming from different sources. And one of those competitions that's currently happening at the moment is in Gorey in County Wexford and in Dunshaughlin in County Meath, where there's various different organisations looking for patronage of these two schools. Now, one of those is CESH, and they're a Catholic Education Irish Schools Trust. And on the line to tell us a little bit more about why they want to get the patronage of these two schools and what they feel it would mean in terms of the national educational space, we have Kate Liffey, who's the CESH Faith Leadership and Governance Coordinator. Kate, thanks for joining us on the programme today. Tell us a little bit about CESH and the work that you do.
So CESH is a schools trust, as you said in your intro there. We were established in 2007 and we currently are, I suppose, the biggest trust in the country. We help manage and look after over 107 Catholic voluntary secondary schools, and we're co-patrons of 34 community schools and community colleges. So that's a lot of schools, that's a lot of experience. And obviously, you know, people would know the name CESH, but they would know about the local Mercy secondary school or the local Presentation secondary school, and those are the schools, those are the kinds of schools that we're trustees of.
And tell us a little bit just about the core values and how they run.
Well, that's a really good question. Like, our core values are really at the heart of everything that we do. So all of our 107 schools have a charter, and this charter, if you like, gives direction and focus and energy to the work. And at the heart of that charter are, I suppose, a number of things that we say that we treasure. So we treasure achieving quality and in teaching and learning. And, like, you know, the Department of Education inspection reports attest to this very clearly. Like, we're really, really good at this in terms of achieving the very best results for students, engaging in the most innovative and most effective teaching methodologies, a broad and rich curriculum, a broad and rich extracurricular program in schools. I mean, this is not just us saying it, this is what the Department of Education and Skills is saying in terms of inspection reports. So I think that's a key consideration for parents. Then, of course, there's other things, because it's not just about academic results. It's also about showing respect for every person. It's about creating community. It's about helping young people understand that they're called to be just and responsible, to be global citizens and to be leaders. And I think for me, perhaps coming from the faith perspective at the heart of Catholic education, is that we're about promoting spiritual and human development. We're in education because we believe a knowledge of and a personal relationship with Jesus Christ gives meaning and purpose to all of our lives. So this is what happens in CESH schools. It happens very much in an invitational way with students, but it's at the heart of what we're about. So our schools are warm, welcoming, home away from home, that kind of a sense of a school. And I mean, they're well known.
And how does it work, Kate, in terms of there's two new schools going to be put in these areas? There's a competition now as to who will get the patronage. How does that competition work?
So this is a new system, I suppose, since about 2011. And this it's really down to parental votes. So basically in four areas, actually, in 2021, there'll be four areas really in the mix: Ballincollig, Bootistan, Blackrock and Dunleary, Dunshaughlin, as you said, and Gorey. And say, for example, in Dunshaughlin, parents who have children in second to sixth class in primary school would have a vote if they live in that, if you like, catchment area. So, or in that area where voting is relevant. So they literally go on the Department of Education's website, they have their child's PPS number and their air code, and they vote for the school that they want.
So it's great, because you're actually asking parents in the area what they want, because I suppose a lot of people, when they hear of two new secondary schools, Kate, and they think, oh, they hear even the word patronage, they might be scratching their head saying, I thought we were trying to, you know, divest more Catholic schools and have more kind of non-denominational schools.
Well, again, that's a really important point. I mean, I think the distinction has to be made between the primary school sector and the post-primary sector. At primary, it's well known and it's well rehearsed in the media in terms of the whole divestment question. At post-primary, the landscape is very, very different. In fact, in 2018, for the first time, we saw very clearly, and this is on the Department of Education's website, the number of multi-denominational post-primary schools exceeded the number of Catholic ethos schools for the first time. Now, that's fine on a national picture, but let's go take, for example, in Dunshaughlin. What does that mean? What does that kind of statistic or that kind of fact mean for the parents of Dunshaughlin? In real terms, it means that if you are a parent in Dunshaughlin or in the hinterland and you want to send your child to an excellent Catholic school, you'll have to get your child on a bus and you have to travel to Navan, or you have to bring your child, or you have to travel, get them on a bus to travel to send them into Castleknock.
And are people doing that at the moment?
Oh yes, in big numbers in Dunshaughlin, this is what's happening, and it's a real shame, because we all know that the very best thing for children usually is that they go to school in the locality with their friends. So, I mean, in the whole deanery of Rathote, there is not one single Catholic voluntary secondary school. So you're talking about a huge, you know, a fairly significant geographical area where there are no Catholic schools. So in Dunshaughlin, this is a massive consideration for parents. I suppose it's not just that it's that piece, but actually, in reality, in Dunshaughlin, in terms of the competition, the school that exists in Dunshaughlin, I'm sure it's a very fine school, Dunshaughlin Community College, that patron, ETB, is seeking a second school in Dunshaughlin. So parents could be faced with the prospect in Dunshaughlin of two schools run by the same patron.
So then it's actually taking away that choice. But then I suppose, as parents are the primary educators of their children, Kate, it's up to parents to speak with their feet. But do you think there's enough awareness that this competition is happening for the patronage of these schools? And, you know, because different kind of patron bodies sometimes people are very mobilised and sometimes they're not.
Well, that's it. I suppose we're relatively new to this in Kesht, but we are learning, and we are finding, as we engage with parents and with priests and with teachers and principals in both Dunshaughlin and Gorey, that there's a real appetite. So there is a very strong engagement from those areas. So, as I say, in Dunshaughlin, we're working with the principals, and in Gorey with the principals, with the teachers, with parents, and with the local priests, to really mobilise people. I think the main thing is that people vote. What we would absolutely hate at the end of the process is if a Catholic parent or a parent interested in Catholic education were to come to us and say, oh, we didn't even know, you know, we didn't realise we were able to vote. So I think it's really important, firstly, that parents know that they have this vote in those areas. Secondly, that they know that they're voting, who they're voting for, what are the options. And I think thirdly, that they're aware that this vote really matters, not just for their children, but actually for the whole town. So what you're really looking to do as a parent in those towns is not just give choice to your children, but give choice to your grandchildren and your great-grandchildren potentially. So it's really key, as you say, that parents get out.
So how do parents vote? As you say, Kate, they have to obviously be living in the area. They have to have a child that's going to be at that age going to that school, you know, in the future, and give their PPS number and all that. So do people go to a website, or what's the easiest way that people can speak with their feet?
In the case of Kesht, obviously we're very keen that people in Gorey and Dunshaughlin will see the high-quality product that we're offering in terms of a Catholic school in those areas. And so you can go to the Kesht website and vote from there, or you can go to the Department of Education's website and vote from there.
Great. So it's up to parents to really show what they're looking for in their area. So if you're in the Dunshaughlin area, or if you're in Gorey and you're thinking about secondary school choice, well, that's how you get involved. Kate, thanks so much for joining us on the programme today. That's Kate Libby, who's the Kesht Faith and Leadership Governance Coordinator. And as Kate mentioned there, you can go onto their website, Kesht, that's Kesht.ie, if you want to find out more. And, you know, maybe you don't live in County Meath or County Wexford, but you might know somebody that does. You know, this is all about kind of mobilising people to make the choices that they want for their children and their education as well. Spirit. Well, in January, our next guest's husband had a serious and life-changing bike accident while commuting to work. The accident left him lying in a coma in Beaumont Hospital. Naturally enough, life has totally changed for him and for his family. And the coronavirus pandemic has also hugely impacted him. You know, one of those areas of just visitors being allowed to come and see him. On the line to tell us more about what happened and indeed about their fundraising appeal called Walk Des Home, we have Des's wife, Tara Dalton, on the line. Tara, morning to you.
Hi, Wendy. Thanks for having me.
So before you tell us a little bit about what happened to Des and about that accident, just tell us a little bit about him. What was his lifestyle and life like before the accident?
Des was very active, very outgoing personality. We run a business called Irish Village Markets. So he was very involved in that, loved what he did. Just a great person. Full of energy, really, and very positive individual.
And obviously a real people person dealing with so many different businesses and traders with the businesses that you ran together.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah.
So tell us a little bit, Tara, just as much as you want to share with us about what happened to Des and the accident that happened in January.
Okay, it was the 8th of January. He was cycling through town, going from one market to another. He went over the Samuel Beckett Bridge, turned right onto the quays on the riverside, the quays onto the cycle track. And we're not really sure what happened, Wendy, but he came off his bike. And when he came off his bike, he hit his head off one of the concrete, half-moon-shaped concrete bollards that separate the road from the pathway. And he had a cycling helmet on, and he actually wore a motorbike jacket as well. But neither of them saved him, and so he suffered two huge bleeds on the brain, and he cracked his skull, and he had to have a craniotomy done in Beaumont later that evening.
And what happened next then, Tara? When did you know how severe Des's injuries were?
He was brought up to the Richmond ICU, and he was put on life support machine, and he was in a coma for he was in a coma for about a week, and he was in ICU for nearly 2 weeks. So I suppose during that time, you know, they were able to, of course it was really serious, they were able to tell us, you know, it was touch and go for the first 10 days. But at that stage, they were only able to see what parts of the brain had been affected. Of course, a brain injury is serious, but they didn't know what the outcome would be at that stage. They were guessing, really, at that stage. They were talking of, like, they would gauge it in terms of years rather than weeks or months, you know. And I remember when she said that to me, a year from now, I nearly died. I couldn't believe it, really, that's the time frame that we were talking about, you know.
Yeah, I imagine you're just in total shock for quite a time.
Total shock, yeah. You're just trying to process what's happened. You know, your life is perfect one day, and in the blink of an eye, everything changes, you know. And I suppose you never really think at that stage. Like, I sort of thought we might go to Connemara in the summer, you know, that he would be sort of back on his feet by the summer. I never really thought that this could happen, you know.
And what happened next, Tara? Was he taken to a rehabilitation hospital?
So he went from Beaumont, we transferred him to St. Vincent's, and he was in St. Vincent's for 3 months then after that. We were there when COVID came to town. Now, I was allowed to see him in St. Vincent's on compassionate grounds. So I was in with him all the way through that. And then on the 8th of May, he was moved to the National Rehabilitation Hospital in Dunleary. And he's been there since.
And has family been able to visit Des there, Tara?
Well, when he went in first, then they had very strict policy in place around visiting, and I wasn't allowed in for the first 4 weeks, and
that must have been agonising for you.
It was just awful to see him on a screen, and Des can't speak, so he can't communicate with me, you know.
So your communication is squeezing the hand and being there, being present.
Yeah, like, he blinks his eyes and he can whisper a few words, but it was just awful when I couldn't go in, and I was really upset, and he started to regress, you know, and like, he was sort of saying a few words before we went, and I remember the day he was going, I sort of moving to the NRH, I said to him, are you looking forward to it? And he whispered, the sooner the better. And they took him in, and they wouldn't let me through the door, and he had a sore on his back, and they put him into bed because that was the priority, to get rid of the sore, and that was the only way to do it. And I don't think the poor guy knew what was going on, really, you know. And he started to regress. So about 4 weeks later, I think the nursing staff saw that they had to let me in, so they got me in. And then I was allowed in nearly every day for the next, during the summer. And then when level three came in there in September, they stopped all visiting again. And that was the night I walked out of the hospital that night, knowing I wasn't going to see him again for a while. And I decided I have to bring him home, because he's only seen the kids three times over the summer.
How old are your children, Tara?
My kids are 9 and 12.
Gosh.
Yeah, so they saw Des for the first time after 6 months after the accident. That was the first time they could get to see him.
And how have they been coping? It must be very difficult for you to try and be strong for them, but it, you know, 6 months in the life of a 9-year-old and a 12-year-old might as well be 6 years.
I remember when it happened first, and I said to my little one, I was trying to tell her that Dad had an accident, and she was sort of saying to me, when will he be home? And at that stage I said, oh, he'll be home in a month. You know, and she started to cry, and she's like, a month? I can't, like, you know, that's such a long time. A month is such a long time to a 9, if she was then 8, to an 8-year-old, you know. She couldn't believe that she wasn't going to see her dad for an 8, but it actually was 6 months before they got to see him. So, yeah, like, their worlds have been turned upside down. You know, I think my 12-year-old really misses him. It's a very bad age for your father not to be around. He's just gone into first year. Des would have done a lot of training, you know, football training with his football team. So it's a big loss for Daniel, you know. And
it seems almost inhumane that they haven't been allowed to see their father in such a long time, Tara.
Yeah, well, like, they have now seen him a few times, but again, they haven't seen him now for a couple of months. And yeah, it's you know, this is why. We have a video of Des up on the GoFundMe page. And on that video, you see when the kids meet him for the first time, and you can see the difference in Des's face when he sees the children. Do you know, like, he smiles, and that smile holds for about 20 minutes, half an hour, and he's just so delighted to see them. And, you know, after they stopped me going in and allowed me back in to the hospital, you know, he started to improve little by little again. And I just feel it's...
Being at home is going to help his recovery, and being able to see his family and being able to be with you, his wife.
Absolutely.
So tell us a bit about that. It makes perfect sense, I know, to anybody listening, why you would want to, as the fundraising appeal is called, walk Des home. But tell us a little bit about it, and in practical terms, what you need to be able to have Des at home, Tara.
Yeah, so I've just sort of... I'm looking at the next 2 years. That's all I can do. You know, I can't think further than that, because who knows what's going to happen. So in those days at the moment, he needs 24/7 care. He can't do really anything for himself. So the HSE will give me a package, but I'm nearly sure it won't be anywhere near what we need. So I have to fill the gaps after that. So I imagine I'll get something like 40, 50 hours a week from the HSE, and then I have to fill the gaps. So he needs, you know, I'll have to have carers, nurses, overnight carers, because he needs to be turned a couple of times a night. He will then need physio, he will need OT, he'll need osteopathy. He may need to go to the UK or Germany for more intensive rehab next year. First of all, the initial priority is to get him home. And
you feel, just in terms of the benefit in terms of his care, Tara, you feel he'll do much better at home rather than in the rehab hospital, simply because he can't be with you?
Well, he's due for discharge actually today from the rehab, but they've kindly said that they'll keep him until we get a plan, because I have to move house as well. So until we get a proper plan and a package in place. So yeah, absolutely, I believe it's the only, because under normal circumstances he would probably move on to somewhere like the Royal Hospital in Donnybrook, or he'd do a shared care, so he'd come home for a couple of days. Just with the way COVID is, that can't happen at the moment. And I just feel, I really do feel that mental well-being is so important to his physical recovery, you know. And, you know, being cut off from us it's just not good for, it's not good for any
human. It's not right.
Like, this is his hour of need, you know. He needs to be with his family and friends. And usually, under normal circumstances, we would have all been going in and out of the hospital. You know, he would have been able to come home for a couple of nights at this stage, at the weekends. None of that can happen at the moment, you know. And I can see that he's indicated to me that he's really, really lonely. So I've been left in a situation because of what's going on that I have actually no choice but to bring him home. Yeah. I can't put my.
It's one of these hidden, really detrimental impacts of this, of the restrictions and of this pandemic that people mightn't have thought about. And you've certainly opened their eyes to it this morning, Tara. How can people support your fundraising campaign?
Yeah, we have a GoFundMe page. So it's GoFundMe.ie and it's Walk Des Home. And you know, the response to it has been absolutely phenomenal, and I'd just like to say a huge, huge thank you to everybody who supported us, because without everybody's support, I wouldn't be able to do this, you know, because it's so, so expensive to have the sort of care at home that Des needs.
Well, Tara, thank you so much for joining us on the programme today, and you certainly have my prayers, and I'm sure the prayers of many listeners today, for yourself, the children, and for Des to make a full recovery, and please God, you will be able to get him home.
Thank you, Wendy. Thanks so much.
Spirit. Well, something that has been very interesting to watch just in terms of the narrative and media coverage has been the appointment of US Supreme Court Judge Amy Coney Barrett. Now, she has 7 children, and one of the more bizarre recent attacks is that she's been now subjected to personalised attacks, among other things, over how she manages to juggle her career and care for her family. There was a recent article headline stating, "What's Amy Coney Barrett's childcare secret?" And then the article went on to negatively imply how she could have a family and also a professional achievement. Even though this is something, if she fitted into another ideological box, so-called feminist, but I would say that arguably they are faux feminists, would be applauding her for. Isn't this the type of female role model we want to have? Well, someone who wrote about this recently, it joins me on the line. I have columnist for the Irish Times, Breida O'Brien. Breida, morning to you.
Good morning to you, Wendy.
Well, take us back a little bit. Tell us a little bit about who Amy Coney Barrett is.
Well, she was most recently in the news, obviously, because she was appointed to the Supreme Court, and that was contentious because the Democratic Party wanted to wait until after the election because she wouldn't be their favourite candidate, because in her personal life she would be somebody who is anti-abortion and a devout Catholic. But that's not the whole story to Amy Coney Barrett. She's an incredibly accomplished lawyer, and I was touched, given the nasty nature of what some women said about her, that some men who are on the opposite side of the divide to her and wouldn't agree with her views on a lot of things, whether it be on the law or on other things, were saying that she was always the brightest person in the room that she was in, and that she was a meticulous and absolutely praiseworthy constitutional lawyer, and that they all acknowledged her brilliance and so on. And of course, she famously didn't go to one of the famous law schools, but she went to Notre Dame instead, and she would be the first person actually from that law school, and then she later taught there as well. So highly accomplished woman who has 7 kids, 2 of whom are adopted from Haiti, and the youngest has Down syndrome.
And the narrative kind of continued from there in terms of the negativity. And I think it's fair to say, Breida, that had she, as I say, fitted into another ideological box, you know, if she was very pro-choice and flying that flag, that she would probably be being celebrated. Is there a huge double standard here?
Well, I think it's a double standard that is causing huge damage to feminism. It's making it more and more difficult for women to actually identify with feminism because, as I said in my article, instead of reading The Handmaid's Tale, which ironically portrays Catholics as an oppressed minority, they should be reading Animal Farm, because it seems to be that, you know, the famous sardonic slogan that Orwell had, all animals are equal, but some animals are more equal than others. It seems when it comes to women, all women are equal, but some are more equal than others. If Amy Coney Barrett didn't have the kind of views that she had, they would be dancing in the street, because you have this strong, capable person who is also a mother and who is highly accomplished, reaching the highest court in the land while she still has school-aged children. And to me, it's actually damaging the cause and dividing the cause that you absolutely have to fit into this very, very narrow box to be celebrated.
So tell us a little bit about the kind of latest attack, because there's been so many, again, that would be unheard of if we were talking about a woman that fits into that little, small, narrow box. You know, so-called feminists have attacked her for the type of clothes she's been wearing, yes, and various other things. But now the latest one is you know, something which we're constantly talking about here in Ireland, which is trying to juggle career and childcare. And they're saying that she's doing a disservice in this area. I can't get my head around it.
Well, it actually made my head hurt, because basically there was a slew of headlines everywhere, from kind of the Washington Post to Slate to Harper's Bazaar. And one from Slate was, "The women can have it all" narrative around Amy Coney Barrett is a trap. And basically she doesn't believe what Amy Coney Barrett is telling us about childcare. She has been totally open about it. She has said that they relied really heavily on her husband's aunt, who provided live-in childcare for them. They had a babysitter who came with her to her confirmation in the Rose Garden. And the most interesting thing, I think, for many of us, is that her husband does a huge amount. He also has a high-powered job, but he does a huge amount of the ferrying and the carrying that's an inevitable part of a large family.
And isn't that a good thing? Isn't that something that we women have been trying to say? Let's share the load better. Isn't that a positive? And they're attacking her for that?
It's absolutely crazy. I'm sorry, it is crazy. Now, on Twitter, of course, is a cesspit, but there was a tweet, and in fairness, the woman who tweeted it absolutely got murdered for it, and rightly so, because she said, her name is Vanessa Gregoriadis, and she said, "I don't understand about Amy Coney Barrett is how a potential Supreme Court justice can also be a loving present mom to seven kids. Is this like the Kardashians stuffing nannies in the closet and pretending they've drawn their own baths for the kids?" So basically she's saying it's impossible for someone to balance their absolutely paramount needs of their family and of their career. Now, in fairness, people did pile on her, but then other people came back, like an author in Slate, saying, "Oh, well, that was a little bit crude what she was saying." But in fact, you know, how does she do it, and how does she keep that big house clean? Seven kids is so many kids, and it's all so patronising and also kind of piling on another woman. I just found it really ugly.
Isn't it bizarre, Brita, that wouldn't the conversation be much more fruitful if it turned to, okay, she's been able to do it because she's got her husband and the aunt and all these things, but how can we make it so that every woman has, if they want to be able to work full-time or part-time or whatever, has access to the childcare they need, whatever situation they're in? Why has the conversation not gone down that road?
Well, I don't understand that. And the extraordinary thing is that the Coney Barretts have been very humble about the fact that they are privileged. They're both in professions. Amy Coney Barrett, prior to this, was in academia, where there was a degree of flexibility. And then she was appointed as a judge in a lower court. And she was so close to home that she could literally leave her court and go down and work for a while in her child's primary school and come back. So they're acknowledging their privilege. But there's nothing about, they are not the ones who are damaging the cause of women. Like, we need a conversation about how do we make this happen more often. How, you know, the other part of feminism which was supposed to happen was that men were supposed to become involved. And, you know, we all know wonderful men who are really involved. And then people do also need support from the state to be able to do what they feel is best for their family. So I believe that women who stay at home should not be penalised by the tax code because they only have one income. And equally, I believe people who decide either to work part-time or full-time should be helped to do what is best for their family. And that's where the conversation should be.
It's really about supporting authentic choice in all of those areas.
Absolutely.
Do you think, Brita, part of this is about there's quite a poisonous narrative, I feel, that is being, you know, directed especially at young women, where, you know, when I think of that actress who was holding her Golden Globe, Michelle Williams, and she basically said, "I'm holding this this because I exercise my right to choose. So this quite dangerous narrative that says if you want to have it all, then you need to be able to, you know, end the lives of your children. Whereas there's Judge Barrett holding the hand of one of her seven children, and it really is flying in the face of this kind of lie that we're being told that in order to succeed you need to either have less children or have abortion available to you.
Yeah, and I mean, it's funny, that's how the Slate article actually ends. That's why mothers need the kinds of social support, including access to abortion care, I love that word, that helps them to keep their family at a size they think they can handle. Now, so it is a poisonous narrative. It is the idea that that women cannot have children and also have a career. And it's even more poisonous than that because it implies that the only solution is that you have to have access to abortion. Now, the fact is, in the modern world, in the Western world, women are not able to have as many children as they would like to. That is being consistently shown, survey after survey, that generally speaking, women would like at least one more child than what they actually have. So can we look at the reasons why they're not able to have the children they want to have, rather than saying to them, you need to be able to get rid of the ones that you're actually carrying in order to succeed?
It's a very interesting and important point, Breida. As always, thank you so much for joining us on the programme today. That's Breida O'Brien, their columnist for the Irish Times.
Thanks for listening to our Spirit Radio podcast. Don't miss out. Subscribe today. Find out how at spiritradio.ie.